This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening. Thank you for being with us. I'm Leon Morris. I'm the president of Pardes. And this has been a big week for us at Pardes. We had a groundbreaking on Sunday for our new home. And we're in the midst of a very exciting executive learning seminar, the theme of which is war and peace, which led us to our speaker tonight. We're absolutely delighted to kick off our summer lecture series with Mati Friedman. And before introducing Mati, I want to thank Huti and Jay Pomerantz for sponsoring our entire summer evening lecture series. The series is in memory of Brondel Pomerantz, Jay's mother, and we pray that this series will bring honor to her memory. Thank you for your sponsorship. I'm really pleased to introduce Mati Friedman. Mati grew up in Toronto and made Aliyah in 1995. From 2006 to 2011, Mati was a reporter and an editor in the Jerusalem Bureau of the Associated Press. His first book, The Aleppo Codex, A True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible, was published in 2012 and won the Sammy Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature, the American Library Association Sophie Brody Medal, and a host of other awards. He'll be speaking this evening about his most recent book, published in 2016, Pumpkin Flowers, A Soldier's Story of a Forgotten War. Mati has had at least two essays appear in the New York Times over the past year. The last one, just a month ago, offered a sobering critique of the foreign press's coverage of the events of May 14th at the Gaza border that denies the coverage which denied the complexity of the situation and granted Hamas success in what Mati characterized as, quote, a war whose battlefield isn't really Gaza, but the brains of foreign audiences. But back in November, Mati wrote a stunningly beautiful essay about a British Commonwealth cemetery in the neighborhood that he and I and many of you call home, just up the street from here in Arnona. In this cemetery, Indian soldiers fighting for the British are buried from the battle in which Britain captured Jerusalem in 1917. And Mati concludes this essay by describing what he thinks each time he passes the cemetery, what he calls a soldier's lesson. Quote, that victory and defeat never mean what you think, that with all of your weaponry and with all of your weapons and illusions of power, you're simply born this way, and that by tides beyond your grasp, and that all anyone can safely say about the future is that it's nothing we can picture from where we stand. I have the privilege of being Mati's neighbor, and he's one of those people for whom you make a point of crossing the street in order to engage him in conversation. Mati is somebody whose warmth and openness and lack of pretense belies the boldness and honesty of his writing. Mati has a keen intellect and a sensitivity that allows him to see and then describe his world in ways that both illuminate us and move us to tears. It's my pleasure to welcome Mati Friedman.
I'm never going to live up to that, so don't get your hopes up, or it'll be a big disappointment. It's a real pleasure to be here. It's so nice to be speaking in our neighborhood. I just walked right down the hill, less than 10 minutes, and here I was, so it's great to be here. What we're going to do in this brief discussion, which falls in what sounds like a fascinating week of discussions on related topics, is we're going to discuss a war that isn't really considered one of Israel's wars. Many people don't even think of it as a war, but I think that it is not just a key episode in Israeli history, but it's a key episode in world history. And once we understand a bit about it, many things about the country become clear, and many things about the century become clear, this 21st century, this bewildering century in which we find ourselves. I moved here in 1995, I was 17, and I moved here from Toronto. I understand that there are at least two Canadians here, so there should be more, obviously, I guess we'll see what we can get. I came here with some pretty simple stories in my head about what this place was. And I think the stories would be familiar to most of people in this room who have learned about Israel and North America and who have come here from North America. The story was a story about Jewish rebirth and Zionism, and I knew, and the kibbutz seemed very large in my brain, and I ended up on a kibbutz, a very small, at the time, failing religious kibbutz 2 hours north of Jerusalem called Ma'ale Gilboa. That's where I ended up for reasons that are hard to explain. And I decided that I was going to stay. And I found, after making the decision to stay, that the ticket into Israeli society, the way to get in, is the military. And I was the right age for it. And as soon as I became a citizen, it triggered the draft machinery. And very soon, after having made the decision to come here, I found myself, soon after making the decision to come to Israel, I found myself in another country called Lebanon. And I found myself on a hill about 5 miles north of the Israeli border. And this hill was a concrete emplacement with bunkers and trenches. And it was a very confusing place. The country was stunningly beautiful. If any of you have been in South Lebanon, then you know that South Lebanon looks a lot like the Galil, but it's even more beautiful. It's even more dramatic. So I was in this beautiful place, which was very dangerous. So we were there, and it was this incredible landscape, this breathtaking landscape, but we weren't there to enjoy ourselves because behind every tree or around every bend in the road, something awful could be waiting. The rocks, the boulders along the road could be bombs disguised as boulders, and the shepherd with his sheep could be a scout for Hezbollah, and there were Shia Muslims around, and there were Christians around, and I understood that the Christians were our friends, but they didn't seem like our friends, and they spoke Arabic, and I didn't know that there were Christians who spoke Arabic. It was all very confusing for a kid from Toronto who had come here with some very primitive ideas about Herzl and the kibbutz movement. And that was more or less when my education began, with me standing in an emplacement in Lebanon, looking out at this baffling landscape and realizing that I had no idea where I was. And everything I've done more or less since then, until this day, my career as a journalist and my time in university, and everything I think has been an attempt to grapple with that confusion and put together what is actually going on, primarily for myself, and then only secondarily for others who may be interested in reading the articles and the books that I've written. The Lebanon episode, which doesn't have a name, we'll discuss that in a second, ended in 2000. And those of you who were here or were following events remember that the army withdraws from Lebanon in the spring of 2000, which is around the time that I got out of the army. And after that, more or less, the entire experience was forgotten. And almost nothing has been written about it. For years, I was waiting for the repressed memory to surface, for it to become a topic of discussion. Here and there would be little flashes of memory. So there was a movie called Before, which some of you might have seen. It's based on a Hebrew novel that was written by a writer named Ron Leshem, which is quite good, and I recommend reading it. And that was it, more or less. And this was the defining generational experience for people my age, and I expected there to be more about it. It seemed to me then, and it seems to me now, that you can't really understand Israel without understanding what happened in Lebanon in the 90s. And yet no one does, and no one seems to even remember that it happened, with the exception of the soldiers who were there and their parents, for whom the experience loomed perhaps even larger than it did for the soldiers, who after all were 18 and couldn't quite understand what was at stake, when I now understand as a parent myself that the parents understood what was at stake. It's just that we didn't at the time. So I sat down in 2012 and I tried to write a book about it. And the book that emerged is called Pumpkin Flowers, and it was published in 2016. And what it is an attempt to place this war, because that's what it was, and we don't call it a war, it was a war, on the timeline, on the Israeli chronology, and explain its importance, not just to the way Israeli society looks today, but to the way the world looks today. Because I think if you understand what happened in Lebanon in the 90s, much about the war in Iraq becomes easier to understand. Much about Afghanistan becomes easier to understand. Much about the kind of information or perception warfare that we see around us, videos, ISIS videos, terror attacks that seem to have no purpose beyond altering perception, terror attacks that are not an attempt to capture territory, so not classic warfare, but are rather an attempt to tell you a story. This is a different kind of warfare, and it's rooted in many ways in this experience in Lebanon in the 90s. And that's why it's worth discussing, at least a bit, and that's what we'll do very briefly here. What was this war in Lebanon? What do I mean when I talk about this war that doesn't have a name? Israel goes into Lebanon in 1982. I know that at least one person here was involved in that later because I saw a picture of him in uniform. How old were you at the time?
Late 20s.
You were Miluimnik. You were doing your reserve duty. Israel invades Lebanon in 1982 because of the threat of Palestinian guerrillas who had set up along the Israeli border inside Lebanon and were raiding across the border. And there were terrible terror attacks that came out of Lebanon. If you remember the attack at the school in Ma'alot, and the attack, there was more than one attack in Nahariya, which is the town where my parents live now in northern Israel. Israel goes into Lebanon in 1982 with the idea of pushing the PLO back from the border. That was the stated plan. That plan concealed a different plan, which was to get to Beirut, replace the Lebanese government with a government that would be more conducive to a peace agreement with Israel, and remake the regional landscape by this kind of dramatic and daring and ultimately unsuccessful military move. The Israeli army ends up in Beirut, even though no one had understood that that was the idea, including the Prime Minister of Israel. The army ends up in Beirut. It gets very quickly bogged down into the Lebanese civil war, which is these intricate factional fights that Israel does not understand going in. That fall, we have the massacres at Sabra and Shatila, which I know you've discussed here at Pardes, and the thing begins to fall apart. In 1984, the Israeli government decides that it's pulling out of Lebanon, and it pulls the army back. There's a government decision to withdraw from Lebanon entirely, but to leave a security zone along Israel's northern border inside Lebanon that would be controlled by a Christian militia affiliated with Israel, which came to be known as the South Lebanon Army. In Hebrew, Tzva Adlom Lebanon, Sadat. The government decision included two words, which ended up shaping the fate of a generation of Israelis. I don't think that's an overstatement. It said that the security zone would be under the control of the South Lebanon Army, that is our allies inside Lebanon, b'siyua tzahal, with the help of the IDF. In Hebrew, those are two words, b'siyua tzahal. And it turned out very quickly that the Christians could not control the security zone on their own, and b'siyua tzahal, two words, turned into an entire world of Israeli outposts and ambushes and convoys and thousands of soldiers going in and out of these strange emplacements in South Lebanon. Now, at the end of the 80s, this starts in 1985, until the end of the 80s, more or less nothing too dramatic happens in South Lebanon. There's a steady drip of casualties, but not enough to really grab the attention of the Israeli public. The Palestinian guerrillas, who've been the original threat, the reason that we've gone into Lebanon, disappear, and they're replaced by a different enemy who we hadn't expected going in. One of the characteristics of modern warfare, and this is certainly true of Iraq, is that you go in for one reason and you find yourself fighting a different war. So we went in to fight the Palestinians and found ourselves fighting the Shiites of South Lebanon, who became represented most memorably by an organization called the Party of God. In Arabic, Hezbollah. Now, everyone knows Hezbollah today. It's one of the most important players in the Middle East, but it starts off as a ragtag bunch of locals from South Lebanon, and it evolves over the course of the 1990s into a very effective fighting force under the guidance of the Iranians. Now, when I say things like Hezbollah and Iranians, this is all very familiar to us now, because, of course, we understand that the Iranians are very much a threat, and we understand that Hezbollah is a very potent threat in Lebanon. No one had any idea about this in the 80s, and it came as a surprise. And by the beginning of the 1990s, which is really when the story starts, the stage had been set for this very strange, very costly, ultimately very controversial and failed war in South Lebanon. You had this local force, Hezbollah, trained by the Iranians, which was becoming increasingly effective. And Israel was discovering that this was not just another band of ruffians with Kalashnikovs, like the PLO factions, that they were. This is a much more potent enemy. And you had Israeli soldiers spread out across South Lebanon in a string of outposts miles into Lebanon, which is called the Red Line, the outposts of the Red Line. Now, these outposts, if you remember from the time, the outposts had beautiful and very strange names. My outpost was called Outpost Pumpkin, Mutzav Dlat, but all the outposts were named for vegetables and flowers. So near our outpost, Outpost Pumpkin, was Outpost Red Pepper, Mutzav Gamba, and Outpost Citrus, and Outpost Cypress, and there were outposts named for orchids, and the names of the outposts were these beautiful kind of bed and breakfast names, and these were pretty grim places. They were concrete emplacements with machine guns, usually on hilltops, and that was the Red Line inside Lebanon. And if you were a serious soldier in the 1990s, that's what you were doing. That's what guys in combat units wanted to do. The other option for combat soldiers in those years, service in the territories, was considered less desirable because the real business was inside Lebanon, and that's what you wanted. You wanted to get into Lebanon, and you wanted to go as deep into Lebanon as you possibly could. So the worst outposts in Lebanon, the most dangerous ones, some will be familiar to you. One is Beaufort Castle, which is a crusader fort that was taken over by the PLO and then taken over by Israel, and Israel put an outpost there. North, even further inside Lebanon, was Outpost Pumpkin and Red Pepper and Citrus. And even farther north was Outpost Basil, Mutzav Reichan, and a few other outposts. And there was a whole world inside Lebanon. Just a note about that language. I don't know how many of you have actually spent time in the Israeli army, but if you have, then you might have noticed that the Israeli military language is bizarrely floral. The Israeli radio jargon and the code language in the Israeli army is heavily horticultural and agricultural. And I've thought about this, I've written about this, I wrote an article for The Atlantic about the language of the Israeli military, which you can find if you're interested. No other army speaks this language. So we have these outposts that are named for, your garden, the plots in your garden. And when I arrived at Outpost Pumpkin as a radio man, they made me the radio man, even though I'd been speaking Hebrew for a very short period of time. And I had to learn a new language, which was kind of like Hebrew, but not exactly Hebrew. I discovered that everything had a euphemism. So some of the euphemisms were kind of predictable. So a female soldier was a skirt. That doesn't surprise anyone. But some of the euphemisms were very strange. For example, a casualty on the Israeli military frequencies is called a flower, perach. So if you have to report a casualty, you say, yeshanu perach, we have a flower. Now, in the British military, and I've spoken to British soldiers who served in Afghanistan, they have a very technical jargon, which is like the U.S. military. So in the British Army, if you have a wounded soldier, you would say, we have a T4. If it's a fatality, you'd say, we have a T6. In America, an American soldier would say, we have a KIA, killed in action. Now, what's going on here? What are these euphemisms? Why can't you just say, we have a dead soldier? Part of it is technical. Part of it is a desire, I would say the large part of it, is a desire to give very young soldiers tools with which they can distance themselves from what they have to describe. It's not code, because it's not secret, right? I can tell you that on these radio frequencies, Pelach is kind of, it's not a military secret. I just know, as someone with young soldiers, that a 19-year-old soldier can't say, my friend just lost his leg. You can't. So you need to be equipped with a language that distances yourself from what just happened. So you say, yesh li perach, we have a flower. If it's a fatality, it's harduf, an oleander. This is a very beautiful language. An oleander is a poisonous flower. I'm not sure that was on purpose, but you would say, yesh li harduf, if you want to call in a helicopter to evacuate your flowers, then it's a thistle. Dardar. That's a helicopter on the frequency. When I arrived at the Pumpkin, we had this system that warned us of incoming incoming mortar shells. It's a radar system that saw incoming shells and warned us before they hit, usually not long enough before they hit, but it did warn us a few seconds before, and it was called Buttercup. Nourit. Marechet Nourit. Now, I have never served in the Marine Corps, but I'm quite sure that nothing in the Marine Corps is called Buttercup. And it's beyond, there are other weapon systems, the tank's night vision system is called Artichoke, which is cute. You can't imagine anyone getting hurt by an artichoke, but people often were, sometimes them and sometimes us. names of units are often plural. We have a unit that goes these days, it's the West Bank, goes in and out of the West Bank to arrest or kill wanted terrorists, and that unit is called Cherry, Duvdevan. Now, if you're in Israel for long, if you just don't think about how strange that is, units in the American military do not have names like that. And what exactly is going on? Why do the Americans use very bureaucratic language? Kind of like a KIA sounds like a tax form. It doesn't sound like that. It sounds something very bureaucratic. So they like the British, move very quickly to a bureaucratic language, T4, KIA. And we have this bizarre floral language. So I spoke to a linguist named Uviko Rosenthal. I don't know if that name means anything. He's a very prominent Israeli compiler of dictionaries and a kind of a Hebrew expert who lost a brother in the Yom Kippur War. And we had an interesting discussion about the origins of this language, which are unclear, according to Uvik, but are quite obviously rooted in the Palmach and the kibbutz-centric culture of the early Israeli army. And the whole culture here, at least at first, and it still lingers, is that you're not supposed to want to fight. You're not supposed to like war. There are no military parades here, for example. Fighting is something you have to do, or at least you're supposed to pretend that you'd rather be doing something else. Moshe Dayan would always list his profession when asked as farmer. Moshe Dayan was basically never a farmer. He was always a soldier, but you're not. That wasn't what he thought he was supposed to be. So you're supposed to want to be a farmer. I served in a unit called Nachal, which is a Hebrew acronym for the Fighting Pioneer Youth. And the symbol of our brigade was a sickle. And the Golani Brigade, which is kind of like our equivalent of the Marine Corps, it's kind of gung-ho, not especially disciplined brigade. Their symbol, which you'd expect to be a skull with a sword stuck in it or something, you know, which it would be if it was America with like eagle wings. It's a tree, it's a cute green tree, and they have a rifle, which is called the Tavol, which is a nice hill, Mount Tavol, and that's the language. It replaced an American rifle called M16, which is a classic American kind of term, which is very bureaucratic. That was just an aside about the strange culture of the Israeli army as I encountered it going in. In the mid-1990s. The other soldiers who I encountered were also, I think, not quite what I expected coming from Canada. No one was ideological. Mostly middle-class kids, college-bound after the army. They wanted to be in the army, but they weren't particularly interested in bloodshed and mostly seemed to hope that none would happen while we were in the army. We had two medics who were terrified that anything would happen. They just hoped nothing would happen until they got out. And I would say that of my friends from my platoon, there were 20 of us, except for maybe one or two, none of them would have been in the army if we didn't have a draft. So they were both motivated enough to be in a decent unit of the army, but they were not what I think Americans picture when they think about soldiers. These were kids from regular families who just knew they had to do it. And there was no discussion of ideology. If you discussed ideology, you would be laughed at, right? If I mentioned that I read A.D. Gordon, which I had at the time, the great kind of prophet of Hebrew labor, I would have been laughed at had they known who that was. It just wasn't. The Herzl was a street for them. Right? Ben-Gurion was the name of their middle school. But it was not. So it was not at all ideological. It was just that this was their home, and they were protecting it. And it was very. It was on the one hand, it was surprising, and I think a bit disappointing to me at first. But I came to see it, and I still see it as just much more natural. That was the idea. The idea was to raise kids who would not think about Herzl and Ben-Gurion and not think about why we need this place at all, because of course, why would you think about that? You were just born in it and this is what it is. And I became kind of part of that very, very quickly. Now, before we show a short video, which I think gets at one of the most interesting aspects of this war, just a few words about what the war looked like, what it was. And you had these Israeli units, as I said, in static outposts inside the security zone. And you had tactics, which are now familiar to us from other wars, but which were new at the time. So suicide bombing in the 1980s, so in the early years of the security zone, Hezbollah is using a tactic called suicide bombing. Now, everyone knows what a suicide bomber is now, right? We're so used to it, it doesn't even grab headlines anymore. But Hezbollah introduced the suicide bomber in the Middle East. And the suicide bomber, I think, in some ways, unfortunately, has become the trademark export of the region since that time. And it's one aspect of warfare that comes from this war. But no one remembers because no one knows anything about this war. Hezbollah starts attacking Israeli convoys. The army needs to get its soldiers to these outposts, so they travel in armored convoys. Hezbollah develops what we would now call the IED. No one used that term at the time. It's a later term, improvised explosive device. In Hebrew, we just called it a mit'an, which just means a payload, or a mit'an tzad, meaning a bomb placed on the side of the road. They kind of perfect the IED to a point where it becomes a major threat to convoys going in and out of Lebanon, at which point the army moves to helicopters with tragic consequences, which we'll discuss in a second. But the tactic that I would like to linger on for just a second, because we can actually show it, which is interesting, is the use of video. And the use of video is so common now. We're also used to these videos, these viral videos, that it seems that the world never did without. But of course, that's an innovation. That's an innovation of this century. It's a 21st century weapon. And this war, in many ways, was the first war of the 21st century. The aspects of modern warfare that we can now identify, many of them originate in this war itself in South Lebanon. The use of video is a tactic that Hezbollah in many ways pioneered. They were certainly light years ahead of the Israelis. They were light years ahead of most other groups using these kind of tactics. We have to remember that in 1994, which is when this incident that we're about to see took place, October 1994, there was no internet. Basically, there was no iPhone, there was no viral information. Even satellite TV was relatively new. In Israel, the first commercial television station had begun broadcasting a year before. Until then, there had been one state TV station. So 1994 is medieval times. It's a different era. And in this different era, at the very end of October 1994, it was a Shabbat morning. The Israeli army is still kind of asleep in South Lebanon. They don't really understand the enemy or how effective the enemy is, and they don't certainly understand the way warfare is changing. And there's an incident that takes place at Outpost Pumpkin, which is the outpost where I ended up a few years later, that becomes one of the symbols of the time, to the extent that anyone remembers the time, meaning very little, because very few people remember the time. But for those of us who were paying attention, this is one of the symbols of the time. Shabbat morning, a team of Hezbollah fighters comes up the hill. The outpost called Pumpkin overlooked the Shia town called Nabatia, which is a stronghold of the Shia in South Lebanon, a stronghold of Hezbollah. And the attacks against Outpost Pumpkin used to come from this town through wadis, through these dry riverbeds that led up from the town, which was on a plateau, up the hill toward this outpost. So a team, or several teams of Hezbollah fighters, come up the hill in the morning, daylight. One of the Hezbollah fighters is armed not with a machine gun, but with a video camera. And we'll show the video, and then we'll discuss what exactly we're seeing.
What?
That hill you see in the distance is Outpost Pumpkin, and this is shot from the point of view of the Hezbollah fighters attacking Pumpkin and attacking and advancing to the outpost. Thank you. That's it. That was the whole movie, and it's cut right after the flag. So you saw the fighter plant a flag in on top of Avila's pumpkin, and what does that evoke, at least for an American audience? Iwo Jima, right? There's that classic image of the Marines on Iwo Jima planting the flag. Now, what happened exactly? What do we just see? We saw Hezbollah fighters advancing toward an Israeli outpost, and we saw them planting a flag. That image was broadcast across the Middle East. It garnered intense applause for Hezbollah, which really presented itself for the first time as a credible opponent to Israel. These guys are walking up to an Israeli outpost and planting a flag on it. In Israel, it was seen as a debacle, and it was called the disgrace. That was what the headline writers called it, Habizayon. Soldiers were kicked out of the army because of this incident, because the fighters, the Hezbollah fighters, got up to the outpost without any opposition. They're basically walking, as you could see, and the soldiers are nowhere to be seen. This was a major failure as far as the army was concerned. But what actually happened? One soldier was killed in the incident, a soldier named Amog Klein. And in military terms, what happened was nothing. Right? The line in Lebanon was unaffected. As soon as they planted the flag on top of Apple's pumpkin, they just turned around and ran away. But you don't see that because they cut the video after the flag was planted. And the army tries to explain initially that nothing happened. They say this was an attempt to capture Apple's pumpkin and the attack was repulsed. So as far as the Israeli army is concerned, it was, or at least it could present it as perhaps not quite a success, but at least not a grave failure, because the Israelis didn't understand that warfare had changed and it doesn't matter that nothing happened. By 1994, it doesn't matter that nothing happened. All that matters is the image of what happened. And if Hezbollah can show an image of its fighters on top of Outpost Pumpkin with a flag, the Israelis can run around in circles explaining that nothing happened, but everyone knows something happened because we all saw the video. And as I said, commercial television, Channel 2 here, had started broadcasting a year before. This clip runs in a loop on Israeli TV. It comes into everyone's living room. This is new. This is new. And we start brainwashing ourselves of our own volition. Everyone's watching TV and we're seeing this image. So Hezbollah doesn't have to have a propaganda station like from the Cold War and beam its propaganda into the West or something. Hezbollah just puts out what we would now call a viral video, too good not to show. And the enemy, us, will brainwash itself by itself. And this image remains one of the dominant images of the period, the image of the Hezbollah fighter on Outpost Pumpkin with the flag. Now, if you remember Iwo Jima, that was also a propaganda image, right? The Marines, that was a perhaps not entirely spontaneous photograph. And it was put out for propaganda reasons. Look at us. We captured Iwo Jima. But the Marine Corps, before planting the flag, had actually captured Iwo Jima, which was very, very hard. So the difference between Iwo Jima and this is that Hezbollah understands that you don't have to capture Iwo Jima. Right? Why? Why go to the trouble if all you need is an image? So if the Marine Corps did what Hezbollah did here, all they would have done was stage a photograph in which Marines seemed to be planting a flag on Iwo Jima, and then they'd, broadcast it to the Japanese and say, hey, look, we captured Iwo Jima. And the Japanese could say, no, you didn't, but we have a picture of it. What do you mean, no, you didn't? The mental leap that warfare takes in this incident is, I think, very, very important, and it creates the reality that we're also used to today. The Outpost Pumpkin here is not a military objective in the way the army understands it. Hezbollah is not trying to capture the outpost. What Outpost Pumpkin here is a stage. It's a stage on which Hezbollah is shooting what we would now call a reality TV show. The idea is to have an image that looks real and is in some ways real, right? Because it's actually happening, but what is happening is not what seems to be happening. And in this video, Hezbollah fighters are actors, and the Israeli soldiers, who are not in evidence, but the Israeli soldiers who are in the outpost are also actors. And Outpost Pumpkin is a stage for a play that Hezbollah is putting on for two audiences, for its own followers, saying, look at me, look how brave I am, look at me with my flag. And its second audience is the enemy. It's saying, look how brave I am with my flag, and where are you guys? And it works. It's a genius PR move, and it takes years before Israel catches up to what Hezbollah is up to in 1994. Now, IDF units are often equipped with cameras. Now the army is kind of hip to it. So the army films stuff and puts out its own. It's taken years and years of having Israel's enemies run circles around it before the army catches up, because in the army's understanding, this is not what an army does. Right? We defend the borders and we do operations, and warfare has changed since the 1990s. And in ways that are that almost take it into philosophical realms. If we see a terror attack like the ones we saw in Paris, for example, in 2015, the terrorists are not trying to capture Paris. They're telling a story. That's what they're doing. They're telling a story about their own bravery and about Western weakness. And they choose their targets not based on military merit. Paris has no military value, but based on how much attention the target draws. Because Outpost Pumpkin is one thing, no one really cares about Outpost Pumpkin. But downtown Paris is a place people really care about. So if you can create a deranged scenario in downtown Paris, everyone will be looking at you and the story you want to tell. If you can stab someone in Jerusalem and get it filmed, then everyone will be watching that on their iPhones, and they'll see how crazy you are, how willing to sacrifice you are. You can tell them a story, and people will brainwash themselves, and it won't matter that only one Israeli police officer was wounded in the attack, or that one person was killed, and that you know the casualties and the entire wave of savvy attacks that we had here 2 years ago doesn't amount to the casualties in a single military skirmish of any consequence. It doesn't matter, because everyone's seeing the image, and you forget that it has no military value. Or if you see a plane fly into the World Trade Center, you might know that that is not exactly a military attack, because they're not capturing Lower Manhattan, and Lower Manhattan isn't a military base, and American military strength is unaffected by that attack. It's a story. It's a very powerful story played out for you using real actors on a stage that draws as much attention as possible. Hezbollah was the first to do it effectively, and Hezbollah's many imitators and ideological cousins have perfected the method, and we've seen it in ISIS. Perhaps it reaches its most, at least in terms of production value, its most elegant form in the videos that we see coming out of the stabbing attacks here, parts of Iraq. We see the same tactic being used. It's a way of equalizing the playing field for weak actors. Because it doesn't matter that you can't defeat the U.S. military in Iraq. If you can show good video of an American soldier dying or of an American journalist being beheaded, then Americans will feel weak and they'll feel angry and they'll respond in ways that might not be measured and which might end up playing into your hands. And I think you can argue that 9/11 was an attack like that, and there have been other attacks since ISIS managed to draw America into a very concerted campaign against ISIS by using videos. Whether that campaign was a good idea or not seemed kind of beside the point when those decisions were made, because everyone was so enraged and disgusted by the images they were being shown. And I think people haven't yet developed the tools to step back and say, wait, what did I just see? Who's telling me this story, and why are they telling me this story? And if we look at this very primitive example of that, it's an opportunity to think about the tools of the thinking at work. We often don't take these players seriously because we think Westerners are much more sophisticated, and these are just primitive lunatics with, you know, AK-47s and video cameras. In terms of storytelling, these actors, Hezbollah and its ilk, are more sophisticated than Westerners. They're more sophisticated than us. So that's one mental leap that Westerners should take when dealing with this stuff, is giving the other guys some credit. They know exactly what they're doing. And we need to treat this material with the suspicion that it deserves as a kind of reality TV that's been produced for a reason by very sophisticated people. Okay, that was the flag incident at Outpost Pumpkin in 1994, one of the landmarks, I think, in the development of what we would now identify as modern warfare, but unfortunately forgotten, like the war of which it was part. From that moment, more or less, Israel never manages to regain the narrative initiative. So there are military operations, there are some military successes in South Lebanon, there are raids, there are ambushes, but the story never goes back into Israeli hands. The story that Hezbollah is telling here, which is we're winning and you're losing, turns out to be much stronger than the facts. So the Israeli army can say, listen, this year we killed 50 Hezbollah fighters and we lost 20 soldiers, so that's winning. As far as the Israeli public is concerned, that's not winning. because the Israeli public sees these images and doesn't care that 50 Hezbollah fighters were killed. They only care about the 20 Israelis who were killed, which seems like a lot, and it is a lot. And the same thing happens in Iraq, by the way, where the army can talk about military success, but what Americans see is coffins with American flags coming home, and that hits much harder than any explanation of military success. So throughout the 90s, beginning in earnest in 1994, there are a series of reversals in South Lebanon, and public opinion begins to shift imperceptibly at first, and then in earnest after an incident in February 1997. Now, those of you who were here at the time remember it, no doubt. It was one of the central events of the 1990s. Because of IEDs on the roads, the army begins to fly soldiers in on helicopters. On February 4th, 1997, one helicopter, transport helicopter, is headed to Outpost Pumpkin, which is my outpost. Another helicopter is headed to Beaufort Castle. The IDF outposts at Beaufort Castle. And the two helicopters with 73 soldiers on board collide with each other, and everyone dies. And 73 would be a lot in America too, but certainly in a country like Israel, 73 was like an atom bomb going off in the country. And if you were here at the time, you remember. Everyone knew someone who knew someone. Everyone was affected. The people on board those helicopters were really a cross-section of the country. It's fascinating to look at who was on board, from veteran Israelis and kibbutzniks to, there was a doctor, a military doctor, who was on the helicopters, who'd been a medic in the Red Army and had recently come to Israel with the big Soviet immigration. There was an Ethiopian kid who walked. In one of these stories about families who walked. There were two Bedouin cousins from the north of Israel on the same helicopter. And it was there were cooks. It wasn't just fighters. It was cooks and tech guys and mechanics, and everyone on board the helicopters dies. And that is really the hinge around which the whole period ends up revolving. A few weeks after the helicopter crash, a movement is formed by mothers. And I don't know if they've come up in any of your discussions this week. One of the most effective protest movements in Israel's history, the Four Mothers Movement. And it started by four mothers from northern Israel with sons of army age. And they, after the helicopter crash, decide that the army has to pull out of Lebanon. But that's the solution. That the idea that we need to be in Lebanon to protect our northern border is a concept that is incorrect. And we're losing more lives in Lebanon than we're saving. At first, no one else believes them, basically. And it's four women from kibbutzim, so associated with the left, and they have this idea that a withdrawal is the way to solve the problem in Lebanon. Now, to zoom out for just a second, if you remember that in the 90s, very few people were paying attention to Lebanon except the soldiers and their families, what was the story here in the 90s? Oslo, peace, right? And if you look at the newspapers, which I spent a lot of time doing while writing Pumpkin Flowers, everything is about peace. So you can find Lebanon news on page 4 or 5, but the front page is the peace process, because people here, including myself, thought that peace was nigh, that this was the end, that Lebanon was the end of something. Now, in our understanding from 2018, unfortunately, it's pretty clear that this was the beginning of something, not the end of something. We thought it was the last war of the 20th century, but it was really the first war of the 21st century, and that's something you can only understand in retrospect. We all thought peace was coming, and there were maps in the Israeli papers of the highways that would be built from Damascus to Tel Aviv, and we'd go shopping in Damascus, and they would come to the beach, and it really seemed that that would happen. The phrase, the New Middle East, if you remember, coined by Shimon Peres, Amizrach HaTikhon HaChadash, seemed real. It seemed like it was going to happen. And it, as a kind of an ironic aside, on the same weekend that this happens at Outpost Pumpkin, so in some ways, on the same weekend that 21st century warfare is born, Rabin, who was the prime minister at the time, is in Morocco at an important peace summit with the king of Morocco. And the papers are full on the same day that this happens. This is not the front. This is not the top story. This is at the bottom of page one. The front page headlines in all the Israeli papers are the peace summit in Morocco, and Ma'ariv, which is one of the dailies, has its headline, Bank Bimkom Tank, a bank, not a tank. And that's where we thought things were going, and this was of much less interest. Now, in retrospect, the new Middle East was being born that weekend, but it wasn't being born around the negotiating table. It was being born at Outpost Pumpkin with these guys and their video camera and their ideology, their idea of kind of a resurgent Islam, and their script for what was going to happen in the Middle East has happened. And the script that I believed in and the script that the peacemakers believed in those same years has not happened. And from 2018, it seemed kind of like a collective hallucination. Unfortunately, tragically for those of us who believed in it, we're kind of flash in the pan. And it's very clear that the new Middle East was this. It's just a very interesting way of thinking about what stories we believe and what stories turn out to be true, and it makes you wonder what is going on now, because what you can say with some certainty is that we don't know, that it'll only become clear in 20 years what's going on now. So it makes you a bit more modest, certainly as a journalist, about saying anything about anything, which is not conducive to producing a lot of material as a journalist, in case any of you were considering a career in journalism. So in 1997, this shifts, and the Israeli public, which had been more or less passive about Lebanon because the casualty numbers weren't high enough to garner attention. 2,000 soldiers were dying in Lebanon every year, so families would be devastated. But it wasn't enough at one time to really galvanize public opinion. The helicopter crash changes that. When the helicopters crash, the country is suddenly electrified. Why are these soldiers flying into Lebanon on helicopters? Because there are bombs on the road. Why are they on the road? Because they're going to these outposts in Lebanon, pumpkin, basil, red pepper, etc. Why are they going to outposts in Lebanon? And it turned out that no one had really thought about that for years. And in fact, if you look for a government decision to establish outposts in South Lebanon, you will not find one, because it was never decided by the government. It was a creeping reality that was created over years without anyone really thinking about it and without anyone questioning it, until it became too costly to bear for the Israeli public. The helicopter crash is followed by a series of what Israelis called at the time disasters. There was a disaster, meaning botched or failed military operations. Israelis kind of use very high high explosive rhetoric to describe everything. So it's always the Nazis and the Holocaust and the end of the world and disasters. These were military setbacks. The naval commando unit called Flotilla 13, Shayatet 13, walks into an ambush in South Lebanon. 12 guys die. A group of Golani soldiers are burned to death when an artillery shell lights a brush fire in a wadi in South Lebanon, and there are a series of other disasters that create a death toll at the end of 1997, which was more than 110 soldiers. And that was too much for Israelis. And the Four Mothers movement, which had been marginal, begins to gain steam. And what they were saying, which kind of fit into the zeitgeist of the left in those years, was that the solution is a withdrawal. If you have a problem, the idea is to give your enemy what they want or what they say they want, and that will solve the problem, which is part of the Oslo idea. It's what most of us, I think, believed at the time, and it made sense. They gain steam. You see the public, you see the numbers, which are incredible. They go from something, in the low 20s, within about a year, between 98 and 99, to something like 80%, people on the right begin to support them, and not just people on the left. Public opinion shifts, and when Ehud Barak is running for prime minister in 1999, he declares that if he's elected prime minister, within 1 year, he's going to pull the army out of Lebanon. And he wins the election in part because of that promise, which ends up being, by the way, the only promise that he managed to keep. Not because it was the only promise he wanted to keep, but it was the only promise that that he pulled off. And even if that was the only thing that Barak managed to accomplish, from my perspective as a soldier in Lebanon, I think it was an important move. In the spring of 2000, no one believes in Lebanon anymore. My military service ended up being right in that time. So the shift between the country's behind you to no one understands what you're doing there happens between 97 and 2000. My service was between 97 and 2000. And it was kind of like being a soldier, I guess, in Vietnam between 64 and 65 or something, when public opinion starts to kind of erode under your feet. So I remember my first tour at the Pumpkin, which was in 1998, we were heroes. And in 1999, it was more complicated. Maybe we were victims of bad policy. The public wasn't sure exactly what we were doing. I went into the army in the summer of 1997, understanding still very little, not just about the army, but about the country. Our officer, we went in with about 20 guys to a unit of the Nahal Brigade, which specialized in anti-tank warfare, and our platoon leader was this kind of enigmatic, religious moshavnik from the Golan Heights named Hal'el. And I really liked him, but I didn't know anything about him. There's distance, in the Hebrew word in for the relationship between commanders and recruits in basic training is distance. That's the word in Hebrew. You're not supposed to know much about your commanders. We didn't know who he was. We didn't know his last name. We didn't know anything about him. And as basic training progressed, we understood that there was something about this guy. He was treated differently by the commanders. There was something about this Har-El character, something tragic about him, and eventually it became clear to us close to the end of basic training that Har-El had been sent to officers training at the beginning of February 1997. This is the summer of 1997. There was a platoon of the Nahal Brigade anti-tank company that they had to send someone for officers training, so it was Har-El, and he separated from his platoon and went to the officers training school, which is in the Negev. It's called Ba'ad Echad, training base one. Har-El was in the kitchen washing dishes, which is what, a lot of what you do in the army, including at officers training school, when he started hearing reports of the helicopter crash. And he knew that his platoon was supposed to be traveling up to Lebanon, and it took some time before it became clear that every single person in his platoon was dead except for him. And he went to all the funerals of all of his friends, and then went back to officers training and finished the course, which is 6 months, and then took the next batch of recruits, which was us. We were the replacement platoon, and he took us back up to Lebanon. And once he was asked in a TV interview how he did it, so the interviewer sits down with him and said, this is 1998 or so, and she says, how did you go back? After something like that happened, how did you go back? And I think she was trying to elicit an ideological answer. So I've spoken to soldiers from the Six-Day War who describe being pushed through the alleys of the old city by King David and things like that. You know, there's a lot of kind of mystic and magical thinking. I think that she was looking for something like that, especially from a religious guy. So how did you go back? And Har-El kind of pauses for a second, and he just says, on the bus. in retrospect, and that was it. And in retrospect, that is the motto of the age in Israel, right? It's not, you're not going to find a lot of ideology in this generation, and it's not, you know, we're coming to the land of Israel to be built and rebuilt, or, you know, it's on the bus. We're doing it because we're doing it. And that was perfectly, I think, enunciated by Har-El, who was our platoon commander for about a year and 8 months. Close to the time of the end. So the end came in the spring of 2000, with public support totally eroded, casualties very high. One night at the end of May 2000, the army blows up all of its outposts in South Lebanon. My company blew up Outpost Pumpkin. All of the outposts go up on the same night. They're mined and then detonated as the army pulls out. And that night, they lock the gate between Israel and Lebanon, and the entire war ends, just like that, and is promptly forgotten. Until this day. And it doesn't have a name. It doesn't have a military ribbon. Most military campaigns, including long, drawn-out campaigns like the War of Attrition, they have a ribbon and a name, right? We can talk about the War of Attrition, which was between the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War. The whole affair in Lebanon, which I'm forced to call the affair in Lebanon because it doesn't have a name, has no recognition. There's no monument to it. If you want to know how many soldiers died in it, it's very hard to find that number because it didn't happen. So if you ask the army how many people died, they say, how many people died in what? And you say, well, Lebanon. Like, well, what do you mean? Because there was an invasion in 82, and that war ended in the fall of 82. So it gets very murky, and as astonishing as it is, I think this book is one of the first treatments of that war, and it was written by a Canadian who happened to find himself in it, and it's drawn, it was published in Hebrew as well, and it drew quite a bit of attention because the soldiers who came out of Lebanon had never seen anything written about it, and many of us had, I think, convinced ourselves that it never happened because we'd been 19 and all kinds of crazy stuff happens. You know, you go into the army and just bizarre things start happening to you, and then you get out of the army and you go to South America and you clean out your brain using all kinds of illicit substances, and then you come back to Israel and you become an accountant, and then everything a programmer is probably a better example, and then everything is a bit blurry, like what happened before, and no one ever talks to you about it. So it's not like coming back from the Six-Day War when everyone wanted to hear about it and everyone knows what the Six-Day War is. No one ever asked about it because it never happened. So you begin to believe that it never happened. And when the book came out, it kind of sparked some repressed memories that surfaced, and there are now two TV series being made about the period, and there is more interest in it, and there are people lobbying to have it named, to give it a name, and there are people lobbying to have it to have it be granted a ribbon, totally unsuccessfully to this point, I must add. But at least there is some interest in having that happen. And I'll just end by saying that the country that I live in, I think, can't be understood without understanding any of this. And I realize that that's a personal point of view as someone who is obviously deeply impacted by the events. But when I walk around Israel today, I see Lebanon everywhere. And I see it in the idea, for example, that Israelis have that soldiers are children. Right? Israelis have this idea that soldiers are everyone's children. When one soldier, Gilad Shalit, was kidnapped by Hamas fighters on the Gaza border, that was the slogan that ended up pushing the government to bring him home, that Gilad Shalit is Hayered Shel Kulanu. That the soldiers are kind of joint custody of Israeli adults, and our job is to protect the soldiers from the government, or from their commanders. That's really the way a lot of Israelis think, which is a dangerous inversion of what an army is, and it's rooted in Lebanon. The four mothers, their power was that they spoke as mothers, and they referred to the soldiers as children. And it wasn't bring the soldiers home from Lebanon, it was bring the boys home from Lebanon. L'achzir t'banim, l'achzir t'yiladim. They talked about the soldiers as children, and that really stuck. So that still exists in Israeli society. The idea that Israelis have, think of our own strength and our own ability to bring about dramatic change, is a product of Lebanon. So we go into Lebanon in 1982 with a lot of force and a lot of creativity, all of it misplaced and misguided, but a lot of creativity, and we thought we were going to redesign the region with our army. It doesn't work. It's a disaster. In the 90s, we decide that we're going to do the same thing, but with diplomacy. We're going to have a regional peace agreement, and we're going to do this and that and that, and we're going to have a new Middle East. It doesn't happen. And we pull out of Lebanon in the spring of 2000 with much narrower horizons, with much more, I think, realistic ideas about what we can really change in this region through military means or through diplomatic means. And what you have in 2000 is an Israel that is reduced in many ways. So the old utopian thinking is largely gone. The kibbutz movement, which had led the country to that time and which really found its peak in some ways in the Four Mothers movement, that was a kibbutz. That movement came out of the kibbutz movement, and the prime minister who pulled the army out of Lebanon was a kibbutznik. Barak was born on a kibbutz. That whole Israel collapses in 2000, when a few months after the pullout from Lebanon, the peace talks collapse, and a very Hezbollah-like intifada breaks out in the territories and basically kills the Israeli left and the peace idea. And because there had been two models at play in the 1990s, one had been the peace model, which is that you get Israel to concede stuff by negotiation, and the Hezbollah model was, no, you get Israel to concede stuff by fighting them for a really long time until they give up. And it worked in South Lebanon. And the Palestinians saw that it worked. And you saw Hezbollah flags appear at Palestinian rallies almost immediately in the fall of 2000. And that Israel that had believed in a regional rapprochement, in a kind of document that would, a peace agreement, a document that would change our fate in the Middle East, that Israel is gone. Same year as the Lebanon withdrawal. And since then, more or less, we've been in a different Israel, with different leaders and different ideas. The kibbutz idea, the left idea, has left a vacuum at the heart of Israeli society. It's filled by all kinds of stuff. Some of it, in my opinion, very good. But it's a different country. And sometimes when I walk around, I feel that the country is like the pumpkin. It's like Outpost Pumpkin. Because at Outpost Pumpkin, we were in a bunker. And inside the bunker, we could watch movies, and we had fun. We laughed a lot. It was kind of a funny place in the most bizarre way imaginable. But we were ringed by soldiers in emplacements, and we understood that between us and the Middle East, we needed armed soldiers. And we understand that we live a kind of constricted existence that we are not going to dramatically reshape. So the soldiers that come home from Lebanon, they don't take up politics, and they don't take up settling the country's borders. They don't become, ideologues and political leaders. They go about building very small personal lives. And that fuel, the small personal life, the high-tech company, the art film, the regular life, that's the fuel that's been driving the country since the Lebanon withdrawal. And I think it is in some ways a product of the withdrawal. So the outposts in Lebanon are in a way a kind of incubator for the Israelis of 2018, at least the Israelis of my generation, who are now shaping the country in many ways. And it's a very strange generation that can't be understood without understanding that this was the generational experience, the shared generational experience for us. Okay, I meant for that to be shorter. And because I speak without notes, I actually have no idea how long it was. But if you have any questions about this period or about anything else, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
I have a question about the attack in the video, and I understand the purpose of the video and that they achieved with the video what they wanted. But the two questions I have about it is, why weren't the Israeli soldiers firing, and why didn't they go in and take it? Now, they got what they wanted, but wouldn't it have been more dramatic if they just overrun it and taken the whole thing? So why do you think they did?
Well, right, that's a great question. Where were the Israelis? And if there were none around, why didn't the Hezbollah guys just capture the outpost and have a real victory? So where were the Israelis is a great question, and there were courts-martial that dealt with that question afterward, because that performance of the soldiers in the outpost was not what the army expected from the soldiers. Now, I've interviewed a lot of the soldiers who were there that day, and they were caught completely off guard by this, because nothing like this had ever happened at the outpost. And also, they didn't understand where the attack was coming from. So inside an outpost, it's very hard to see exactly what is going on. You're just being hit by stuff coming from different directions. And there were different Hezbollah teams, not just the ones we saw. There were different teams firing from different directions. So they ended up misidentifying the direction of the main attack. And it was coming from the west. They thought it was coming from the north, and they oriented themselves toward the north and completely missed the real attack. In addition, you saw that there was an emplacement, a big square emplacement that was getting hit by stuff with a slit. That was the outpost, the lookout post at Pumpkin. And it was manned by soldiers who had binoculars and whose job was to look at the landscape, but who weren't combat trained, and they ran away immediately when the attack started. So the outpost's eyes were blind as soon as the attack started, and those soldiers got in trouble afterward, and one of them had a nervous breakdown in the outpost and was never heard from again, basically. And that was part of the problem. The soldiers were blind and confused about what was happening, and by the time they figured out what was going on, the Hezbollah guys were gone and the flag was already on the embankments. And I think as far as Hezbollah was concerned, they never expected to conquer an outpost. I think they were probably surprised that they encountered such light resistance. And you saw there were four of them. That's not enough to take an Israeli outpost. If they were really serious about it, which they weren't, that wasn't the idea, they would have had to come with 100, you know, or 150, because there are about 60 soldiers in the outpost. So they were there for the photo op. They were just trying to get that flag in and get it on camera and get out. And that's exactly what they did. As far as they're concerned, that's all they needed. They weren't looking for a full-on confrontation with the Israeli military, which they would lose. And that's, of course, that's not a Hezbollah insight. The Viet Cong understood it. It's a classic guerrilla insight, which is that you're not going to beat a real army. So what you do is you sting and disappear. You sting and disappear. Tell them a story. You're losing. You try to freak them out. And if you can do that for long enough, even a very strong standing military will buckle and leave. And that's what happened in Vietnam. And that's what happened in Iraq. And that's what happened in Lebanon. That's what happens if you can keep it up for long enough. And they did. Yeah.
World War II era. What? It was real music.
No kidding. I never actually.
You would go to the movie theaters in the 50s, you know, before. And you would have these videos of what was happening, and that was the music.
Isn't that interesting? I never thought. I kind of understood that it was a martial. It was a march of some kind, but it never occurred to me. Isn't that amazing?
There's real music.
So maybe they. So it'd be nice to know, like, who. Obviously, that video was produced by a guy. By Hezbollah guy who did video in 1994. And it would be interesting to know where...
He's in Hollywood now.
Yeah. Maybe he's in Hollywood.
He's a producer.
That's more likely, I'm afraid. It's interesting also that they chose a Western kind of march rather than Arabic music. So the fighters are shouting in Arabic, but it's this Western military music. Maybe that's just what they thought of as a military newsreel type background. It's very, very interesting because there's obviously some thought going on. It's quite primitive, but there is some thought into how it's edited and what happens and the music, and you're not seeing the whole attack. You're seeing things cut, and they became more and more sophisticated as time went on. But that's an interesting insight. It'd be interesting to know why that happened. Yeah.
What did you mean when you said that the eyes were not combat trained, or some people in the army were not combat trained?
So the outpost was more complicated than just infantry. There were different forces that held each outpost. You had usually two infantry platoons, two tanks, so different part of the army, there'd be two tanks at the outpost, and on top of that combat detachment at the outpost, you would have support troops. You have a couple cooks and who made very renowned Lebanon specialties, such as cornflakes covered with melted chocolate. That was a big one. We had very good supplies because this was considered a very dangerous posting, and the army would give you really good supplies. You had chocolate and things like that. We made these toasted kind of grilled cheese sandwiches because we had cheese, which yellow cheese, which you don't really usually get in the army, and we used to toast them on these spiral heaters. That was a big thing. At the embassy, if you watch the movie before, there's a reference in that movie to toasting, which is that. That's what we used to make, these grilled cheese sandwiches. So there were cooks, and there were guys who fixed the armored vehicles, and there were guys who manned various radar equipment, like the Buttercup that I mentioned. And at the time, there were also these guys who manned the lookout posts. And in 1994, they were still not trained as infantry soldiers. They were there just to look, so they had been trained in surveillance or enduring boredom for prolonged periods or something, I'm not sure. But they didn't have the idea that they were part of the fighting force in the outpost, and that was changed after this incident. But as soon as things got rough, and it did, their lookout post was hit. And if they were in it, they'd probably been killed. So running away wasn't the worst idea that they ever had. But they did get slammed for it afterwards. And two of the infantry soldiers who were also manning emplacements on that side of the outpost, they also were absent from their posts for reasons that seemed more logical. One of them was a medic, and he heard that there was someone wounded in the outpost, so he ran to treat the wounded soldier and left his emplacement empty, and it was right at that emplacement that the Hezbollah guys came up. So there were all kinds of events in the outpost which showed basically that they were asleep and not very well disciplined, and the whole attitude of the army in South Lebanon changes after this incident. So when I arrived 3 years later, it's a totally different story. It's very organized, and there are kind of drills for every possible scenario at the outpost. Anytime we heard a gunshot at the outpost, we were supposed to treat it like an attack on the outpost. So there was no what's going on, what should we do? And if you heard a gunshot, which usually turned out to be someone misfiring their weapon because they fell asleep or something, the whole outpost would be on their feet, and everyone would run up to the trench around the outpost, and we were just supposed to shoot for 30 seconds. It was one of the funnest things that we could do as an outpost because you were kind of tense. And this was your chance to kind of blow off steam. So you just take every weapon in the outpost, heavy machine guns. You had these machine guns that shot grenades, which if you're 19, that's pretty neat. The army had this very poetic name for it. It was called a crate of fire. Argaz Esh. And that's what we do. And then if it was a real attack, then we would, I guess, handle it. It didn't happen when I was at the outpost. But that was all, those were all drills that were instituted after this debacle at Outpost Pumpkin. But there's a word on military poetry. The army speaks this language, which is floral, and a lot of it is acronyms that would be much more boring, right? You don't have time in the army, so if you can give something an acronym, you do. Everything has to be short, and most of the language is very, very ugly. The language for gear, the language for things that you need to do. But at certain points, the army had these weird bits of poetry that just got stuck in the military jargon. So, like calling that a crate of fire, for example. I have no idea who thought that up, but it's kind of beautiful. Every day at the outpost began with an alert that started before dawn, because the army believed that the most likely time for an attack on the outpost, on any outpost, was dawn, which I think was completely untrue, as far as my experience went. But there would be a dawn alert. Now, if you are familiar with the literature of the First World War, the dawn alert looms very large. So there's a lot of talk about dawn in First World War poetry, like Flanders Fields, if you know that poem. There's a lot of dawn. Dawn, dawn, dawn. Why are they talking about the dawn? Because they're all awake at dawn. Because in the trench lines on the Western Front, both sides would wake up at dawn, and they would face each other across no man's land in case the other side attacked. So the Israeli army, for reasons that I don't know if they're conscious or not, it also had a dawn alert at the outpost. We'd all wake up, we'd all get in our gear, we'd all prepare for an attack, and we'd stand in the trench looking at the sun as it came up and waiting for an attack. And that was called, could have been called something really short, a dawn alert or something like that, but it was called readiness with dawn. Konenut im shachar, which is strange in the Hebrew too. It's a very strange term, and it's just a beautiful term that they never shortened. There was no reason not to call it Konenut Shacham, for example, dawn alert, but there's always readiness with dawn. And so there's like moments of beauty if you're conscious of language, and even in an army you can find some. Yeah.
Well, big statement and a question. I want to thank you, first of all, for a fascinating
presentation. Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Both on the micro and macro levels, it was personally meaningful because my oldest son was in Lebanon.
No kidding.
Part of that experience, part of the withdrawal, was the Tatzpitan.
No kidding. So that's the Tatzpitanim, the unit that I'm talking about, who became more professional after the 1994 incident. That's the lookouts.
The question is, and correct me if I misheard it before, I heard you say, I thought, that the 1990s produced two different models of peace. One was Oslo, which could have been a model for peace and failed to, unfortunately, fail.
Yeah.
The other was the Hezbollah model I mentioned. But I have difficulty calling that a model of peace.
But yeah, no, I didn't mean a model of peace. I meant a model, for the Arab side, a model for dealing with Israel.
Okay.
Right. Now, the second model is clearly not peaceful. Right. The question is, how do you get Israel to do what you want? Do you humiliate yourself with negotiations and shake the hand of the Israeli prime minister and make kind of arrangements about water? This is all very humiliating. Or do you fight? Do you fight? And even if you become a martyr, that is better than being humiliated. And that dichotomy runs through Palestinian society in the 90s as well. So you have part of Palestinian society, I don't know how big it was. I think we imagined it to be bigger than it actually was, but who believed in negotiations, who thought that this was the way to go, and most Israelis voted for it in the 90s, and we had part of Palestinian society, which was Hamas, in those same years, who was pursuing the Hezbollah script, which is no compromise, keep at the Israelis, keep hitting them, Islam, 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 and in the end, you'll get what you want. And in 2000, when Hezbollah proves that that model works, it becomes very hard to support the other model. And the pullout from Lebanon isn't the only cause of the Intifada that fall, but it looms very large in the outbreak of the Intifada that fall. It's not a coincidence that the pullout happens in May and the peace process falls apart in the fall. It's not a coincidence. Hezbollah showed that it could be done. And once it showed that it could be done, are you going to sit around a table and sign a piece of paper and sign away most of historic Palestine? No. You're going to be a martyr. Unfortunately, that's the direction it took, and we had four or five gruesome years here, which I've quieted down, but I have never been replaced by a different approach. And not only did it catch on here, of course, it catches on across the Middle East. So if we thought that progress on the Western model was what was going to spread across the Middle East, which is what many people thought in the 90s, certainly for the West thought, if you look across the Middle East, you'll see that no, it's the Hezbollah model that has spread. Whether or not the majority wants that or not is irrelevant because no one asks the majority. There are enough Hezbollah-like actors in the Middle East to take the Middle East in the direction that Hezbollah wants. Ironically enough, some of the Hezbollah-like actors are fighting Hezbollah because once you let the genie out of the bottle, it doesn't necessarily do what you want. So Hezbollah in Syria, for example, is fighting Hezbollah-like actors who are Sunni who hate Hezbollah. We hate Israel, for example. So it's kind of unpredictable. But that's certainly the idea that's in play in the Middle East. And that's why Western observers who are looking at this place and still talking 90s language about peace agreements and this and that, I wish that were relevant. It's not. Something completely different is happening in the Middle East, and it's been happening since 2000. And it's only happening more and more. And the dissonance between people who want to believe that the 90s haven't ended and people who understand the Middle East for the basket case that it is, the dissonance is growing. One more question. Okay. Now I have to choose the last question. Maybe I should make you choose, and then you'll be the bad guy. Okay.
Just to stay with this, I got an email today from Ephraim Inbar, and it was in praise of mowing the lawn in Gaza. And for those who don't know, mowing the lawn meaning if we're going to go in, we're going to go in tactically. We're not looking to unseat, usurp Hamas. We're not looking to kick the proverbial tuchus.
Yeah.
We're looking to try to keep some deterrent.
Keep the flames low.
Keep a lid on things. And keeping a lid on things seems to be very consistent with the Prime Minister's approach. Mm. My question is from what you were saying, we seem to have gone in a hafuch way. So Israel was the actor impacting, in the early 80s, even into the 90s, impacting the Arab world. Now we're doing the rope-a-dope to the Arab world, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily. I'd be curious your take on that. Is that something bad? Is that timely? Is that something that is appropriate to the time that we are in, as a prelude to maybe going back yet again to something else?
It's a great question, and certainly that's very Netanyahu, what you described. Netanyahu is not a leader of dramatic moves. He's a leader of the status quo, which I'm not I'll just reveal that I do not vote for Netanyahu or anyone who's currently in the coalition government, but that attitude has a lot to recommend it. And this is a dangerous region, and he doesn't take risks. He was prime minister in the 90s, if you'll remember, and he didn't pull the army out of Lebanon, because that's not the kind of thing he would do. And the rope-a-dope, as you call it, which is an interesting way of thinking about it, which is basically what it is, which is where we, you know, we're kind of dancing, we take a blow, we land the blow, but we're not out for dramatic change, we're not getting rid of Hamas in Gaza, we're not signing a peace deal, we're not, you know, destroying Iran, we're just playing kind of a tactical game and waiting for the whole storm to, you know, play itself out. I think that's as good as we're going to get at the moment. I mean, even if the left were elected next week, which would be nice for me, I don't think we can expect a dramatic change in Israeli policy, because you can't risk, for example, a West Bank pullout. Now, everyone more or less understands that if you create a vacuum in the West Bank, you're not going to get a Palestinian state. You're going to get the Middle East, because that's what fills the vacuum if you create one. That's what filled the vacuum in Gaza, what filled the vacuum in South Lebanon, what filled the vacuum in Iraq, and in Libya, and in Yemen, and any place you make a vacuum, that's what you're going to get. And on the other hand, you know, I don't know what we'd get from attacking the Iranians, which was on the agenda a few years ago. So playing it very safe, playing, you know, behaving like an outpost, right? Pretending we're the pumpkin, right? We're in a bunker, we're on guard, we do little kind of sorties out of the outpost, but we don't try to really change the landscape. We just try to have a good time, as good a time as possible inside the outpost. So we do some, you know, tech innovation, and we invest in the NASDAQ, and we make good movies, like go to film festivals in Berlin or whatever. That's what Israelis are doing. They're kind of living good food, excellent food, some good music, and they're trying to just live life in this constricted reality without being out for dramatic change. And on the one hand, that's logical in this region. And normal life, which is what we have here, is not to be taken for granted. We're a 3-hour drive right now from Syria, where 500,000 people are dead. And we're a 2-hour drive from ISIS insurgency in Sinai, and we're about a 90-minute drive from the Hamas enclave in Gaza. So, you know, real normal life, us being here in this room is a lot. That's a lot. On the other hand, something creative and utopian and crazy about the Zionist movement, which is a crazy, utopian, dramatic movement, has been lost. Because if people played rope-a-dope in Europe in the first part of the 20th century and just said, let's just deal with this, we wouldn't have this country. The country is a product of radical thinking. So when you give up on that thinking, you lose something. And we have an Israel at the moment, which is in some ways better than it's ever been, in many important ways better than it's ever been, and in other ways it's reduced. It's less than it was, and that's a big part of it. I could go on, and by the way, I'm not running out, so you can talk to me afterward, but I'll honorably answer requests. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.